Plunging back into the memories of 9/11, today, Thursday, May 15th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama dedicates the new 9/11 Museum at Ground Zero. Those who visited the space are struck by how evocative it is.
There's that big wall that many people may have heard of, the slurry wall, that divides the site from the Hudson River, and that's very visible. You can see outlines of, you know, some of the early foundations of the Twin Towers.
Also, presidential elections are coming up in Egypt, but in the papers there, you won't see any caricatures of presidential contender General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
The one workaround I really liked in today's paper were just two blank billboards, and it just said the candidates.
Plus, what's up with top women editors plunging off the glass cliff? Journalistic upheaval in New York and Paris after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. This is not the 9/11 anniversary, but today the nation, led by President Obama, once again stopped to remember what happened on that September morning almost 13 years ago now.
Here at this memorial, this museum, we come together. We stand in the footprints of two mighty towers, graced by the rush of eternal waters. We look into the faces of nearly 3,000 innocent souls, men and women and children of every race, every creed, from every corner of the world. Here, we tell their story so that generations yet unborn will never forget.
President Obama speaking this morning at the dedication of the National September 11th Memorial Museum in New York. The first visitors today were 9/11 survivors, victims' families, and rescue workers. Liz Greenspan is the author of Battle for Ground Zero and also an urban anthropologist at Harvard. Those rushing waters that President Obama was talking about, there's a fountain there. I mean, aside from that, what's most important or possibly unique for you about this memorial and this moment?
This is the day that the museum was dedicated, and the museum is actually underground, which makes it a very unique space. It also tells the story of the day of 9/11 through this vivid collection of thousands of artifacts. But it also situates it, or begins to situate it, with the before and the after. There's a little bit, part of the exhibition talks about Al-Qaeda. And then at the end, it looks at the recovery efforts and also mentions some of the policies that followed 9/11, some of which are quite controversial, like the wars that followed. So it brings all together the pieces, or, you know, it attempts to, for the very first time.
Have you been there? Have you seen it already?
I saw a very early version of the museum, and I've seen a number of the artifacts that they'll display, but I actually have tickets to go on Monday as part of this advanced viewing.
You'd think that people connected through the sadness and pain of that day, that there'd be a united spirit in the process of creating this museum. Where'd the controversy come from?
So many pieces have been so controversial about this. And I think in part because so many people feel so strongly about this space, people who come from different backgrounds and with different perspectives, and they want different things from it. So you have victims' families, you have New Yorkers, you have downtown residents, there are architects, and they see it all very differently. They're not a homogenous group. The battles speak to kind of what's at stake here. And I also think as to how unresolved 9/11 still is for a large part of the country.
I mean, personally, I feel Maya Lin's Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington remains kind of the standard for these places where simplicity and space are kind of the frames for the thoughts and mourning of visitors.
Yes, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial absolutely is the standard bearer. I think you're right. And now everyone, in fact, wants their memorials to be like that memorial. And that's the reason why the listing of names has become kind of so de rigueur when we think about memorials. What also is interesting to me is the arrangement of the names. There's an adjacency of people that had known one another in particular ways in the towers. They're not just alphabetical. They try to capture a relationship. Maya Lin, when she did the wall, listed names on the date that they had died as opposed to alphabetically. And in both instances, that arrangement caused a lot of controversy. You know, they're arranged differently, but they both sparked a resistance for people who wanted something simple and ordered and alphabetical. And so there's echoes there between those two events.
How do they deal with the names of Mohammed Atta and his accomplices?
They're not there.
They're not there.
No, the names of the perpetrators are not included, and I don't know if anyone ever suggested that they should be. That was kind of accepted from the beginning.
The museum displays the red bandana worn by one of the rescuers who died in the inferno, also a wristwatch frozen in time. What for you was the most powerful part of the exhibit?
These personal objects are incredibly powerful because they're kind of their everyday things, right, that all of us have, bandanas, watches, wallets. But they've taken on this extraordinary meaning, partly because in some cases they're all that remains from that individual. It's pretty powerful. And in some cases you hear recordings of family members talking about the object, which makes it even more poignant. It's those objects coupled with the big monumental pieces, like there's this crushed fire truck, that brings home the immensity of the destruction and the power when the towers collapsed that I think nothing else does. You can see it, something that's so huge, in fact, is reduced to these scraps. So those couple, that personal scale with this monumental scale, is pretty overwhelming. And I think what will be most important is if this space can promote more discussion and dialogue about what this day means to the country, how we understand it, and how we also have responded to it. Those are things that remain difficult to talk about, but that's what the museum can really promote.
Liz Greenspan, the author of Battle for Ground Zero, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
The big story in New York yesterday was the abrupt firing of Jill Abramson as executive editor of the New York Times. She was the first woman to hold that position, and actually she wasn't the only high-profile female editor to leave a leading newspaper yesterday. So did Nathalie Nougared, the first female editor-in-chief at the prestigious French daily Le Monde. She quit after a power struggle at the paper. Journalist Rebecca Traister has been thinking about what those two events mean. She's written an article about it for The New Republic today with the cheeky title, "I Sort of Hope We Can Find Out That Jill Abramson Was Robbing the Cash Register." Traister says both women were asked to lead their newsrooms during very challenging times.
Both organizations are trying to adapt to a new digital world where their print versions no longer have the same meaning, weight, or power. And so both of these women were running these places in very volatile circumstances, obviously putting them at far greater risk for losing their jobs.
Are you able to tease out for us from these two stories what part is gender, what part is office politics, and what part is the pressure of new technology?
It's impossible to really separate all those things, right? Office politics and gender are very wrapped up with each other, right? The way that employees and bosses react to women versus men in institutions that have historically been male, you know, they're different. And so many of the characterizations of Jill Abramson and also of Nathalie Nougared at Le Monde involve the fact that they were very aggressive, ambitious, perhaps not always warm. I mean, there are different stories about the two of them, but there were echoes of these characterizations in both stories. And of course, those are qualities that are, A, not atypical in bosses to begin with, and certainly not big bosses of powerful organizations, but also that wouldn't be atypical as qualities exhibited by the first women to make these historic moves. You have to be pretty tough, ambitious, and aggressive to get to be the first female executive editor of the New York Times.
Mm. Staff at Le Monde staged a protest last week over Nougared's plans to revamp the newspaper. We didn't see that at the Times, but the complaints of staff at both papers were kind of they were being squeezed, right?
Yes. Well, that's typical of all of journalism and media right now. You know, the economic models that have sustained the news business have fallen apart over the past couple of decades. And so all kinds of people are being asked to do all kinds of unusual things that they're not happy with. And therefore, it's very natural that you take out your frustrations on your boss, and perhaps rightfully so. My observations about how these choices are tied to gender is not meant to say it was wrong for either of these women to step down or get fired from their posts. There may have been very legitimate complaints. There may have been dissatisfaction. But it's also true that they were given these historic posts at a time when the institutions that they were suddenly going to be running were in real trouble and were going to be more likely to experience this kind of unrest and dissatisfaction.
I've seen this phrase, glass cliff, mentioned several times in reference to both these stories about powerful women and, in fact, minorities teetering on this thing, the glass cliff. What is that analogy about?
It's about how groups that have been sidelined, women, people of color, from positions of power, as they move closer to those centers of power, it happens to be at a time when the nature of that power is eroding, so that the positions that had always been held by white men and that were economically or politically powerful, suddenly the power of those positions is diminishing slightly, right? And that's when women and minorities who'd previously been kept from them are suddenly allowed to take over at a moment when the possibility that those positions are going to crash into a wall are greater than ever.
Is that, you think, what's really universal about this story?
It's one of the things that is universal about the story. The other thing that is universal about the story is that when a woman is tough, she will be called pushy and brusque and strident and mercurial.
Women all over the world know that for sure. Yeah. Rebecca Tracer writes for The New Republic. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Newspapers everywhere publish political cartoons, and elections are usually a gift for cartoonists, certainly those here in the U.S., but not in Egypt. Egyptians will elect a new president later this month, yet you won't see any cartoons in the papers there lampooning the main candidate, former Army General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Editors just won't publish any cartoons depicting him. But Egyptian cartoonists and satirists are finding other ways to comment on politics. Two young Egyptian cartoonists are especially known for pushing the envelope. Their names are Anwar and Andil, and our Egyptian satire expert Jonathan Geyer has followed them for the past few turbulent years in Egyptian politics.
These artists, some of the first artists to actually take on the Mubarak regime and learned all of these tricks and workarounds. So by the time the revolution happens in 2011, and they see their cartoons as graffiti in Tahrir Square, they are revved up, and they're drawing a frenetic body of work that basically challenges all authorities, all political elites. They're not just drawing against the military or the government, but they're drawing against the Brotherhood. They're drawing against the old guard in every small institution. So what we have are these, you know, young millennials who are really taking their pens and fighting against a much bigger beast, these institutional challenges in Egypt that have been around for decades.
They seem pretty impatient, Anwar and Andil. I mean, you can understand that. They've had this taste of free expression during Tahrir Square. How long do you think they'll put up with this?
I'm sort of perhaps crazily optimistic. They're certainly outliers, these two cartoonists. You know, there's dozens of cartoonists that are reinforcing a regime narrative. However, when you have these two cartoonists who are willing to really express their principles and their values at this incredibly tense moment in Egypt, you know, these are the guys that hopefully will be writing TV shows. They'll be anchors. They'll be on radio. They'll incubate a whole new generation, just as they were incubated in the last years of the Mubarak regime and learned how to take on authority. I imagine that the young folks growing up today are looking at these cartoons and saying, hey, we can do that.
I'm just wondering if you could compare like an Andil cartoon with a cartoon from one of the more established cartoonists from the old days.
Well, first of all, Andil's style it's very bright and he uses some computer work. So his lines have a really thick, unique feel to them. But I think the punchlines are just so naughty. He's willing to use bad words. He's willing to splatter blood all over an Egyptian family. This is one of the most powerful. Right after Morsi's ouster, when protesters were dying, he drew a nuclear Egyptian family covered in blood, and it said the souvenir portrait of the great Egyptian family. And in that moment, the official newspapers, the old 80-year-old cartoonists, were drawing the military as the absolute savior. So Andil's really willing to question actors at every single level of the Egyptian political sphere, and not afraid to splatter blood on them.
Yeah, so it's a harsh critique, and aesthetically, he doesn't pull any punches.
Right. I mean, one of my favorites was, it's just two people at a party, and this guy's picking up a girl and says, hey, so are you a fascist too? And that might sound really silly, but in this moment where everyone was supporting the regime, Andil was willing to question, what is it to support a military that's, you know, breaking up protests with brute force?
Jonathan Geyer, senior editor of the Cairo Review of Global Affairs. He also blogs about Egyptian satire at Cartoon. Jonathan, thank you as always.
Thanks, Marco. A pleasure.
We've got some of Anwar and Andil's cartoons. You can also read Jonathan's illustrated article about them at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Supersized fries, but no supersized wages. Fast food workers around the world took to the streets today in a global protest to focus attention on the struggles of low-wage workers. It's an outgrowth of a movement by fast food workers in the U.S. to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. In the Philippines, protesting workers held a flash mob inside of a McDonald's in Manila. They sang "Let It Go" from the Disney movie Frozen, except this time the lyrics were "Let go of those low wages." Demonstrations also took place in India, Japan, Hong Kong, Scotland, Ireland. Rallies were planned in 33 countries. In London, more than 100 protesters gathered in front of a McDonald's in Trafalgar Square. "Hungry for justice" was the chant. Julie Sherry was one of the organizers.
We went to Trafalgar Square McDonald's today because we thought this was an appropriate one to choose. It's quite near where our parliament is. It's right in the heart of the capital.
Sherry is trying to focus attention on the issue of zero-hours contracts, which affect millions of low-wage workers in the UK. Under these sort of contracts, workers are not guaranteed hours.
A sort of contract is used to, you know, discipline the workforce in the sense that if you don't come in on your day off because you were called in at the last minute, then you might find out you've got, you know, 4 hours the next week and you can't pay your bills.
Sherry says there's still a long way to go on the campaign, but at least fast food workers there are starting to speak up.
You know, like the strikers in the US would tell you, it's not that they didn't care about the problems that they were facing in the workplace. It was that they didn't think that they had a voice. And so that's what we're trying to raise here at the moment, is that people can have a voice.
We reached out to McDonald's for their voice on today's global protest. They sent a statement saying, "This is an important discussion that needs to take into account the highly competitive nature of the industries that employ minimum wage workers." It went on to say, "McDonald's respects our employees' right to voice their opinions and to protest lawfully and peacefully. If employees participate in these activities, they are welcomed back and scheduled to work their regular shifts." No happy meal when you're not a happy worker, and perhaps not a topic to joke about. Some issues and places just don't lend themselves easily to humor, like war-torn Afghanistan, for instance. Reporter Gregory Warner was convinced that he could find comedy in Afghanistan, though, and he did, in street musician and juggler Zach Warren. Zach told Gregory that he became fascinated with Afghan humor when he was working for an NGO in Kabul. This was just after the Mohammed cartoons had caused a big ruckus.
They can't take a joke. Yeah, that was the thinking.
And so Zach decided to publish the first Afghan joke book to introduce the West to a lighter side of Afghan culture. The next summer,
2006, I went back again.
With the mission to collect jokes from the Afghan people.
Yes.
So what's the first thing you do if you want to find out jokes in Afghanistan?
Actually, you don't even have to look for them. You can sit in a taxi, and if you speak even a modicum of Dari or Pashto,
right,
the taxi driver is going to chat you up. I wanted somebody who could help me out in getting some of these jokes off the radar, you know, jokes who don't get normally told to a Westerner asking around.
You wanted a joke spy.
I wanted a spy, yeah.
Zach found Mustafa, a medical student, 24 years old, same age as Zach was. And Mustafa believed in Zach's mission.
Well, Mustafa basically said, we can organize some joke-telling groups.
Yes.
The gathering worked so well, they had another one with different friends. And the sixth time they have one of these evenings, Zach invites me to come watch. The joke sessions are anonymous, and when I write down names, just for my notes, Mustafa asks if I'm keeping a blacklist and accuses me of being Al-Qaeda. Mustafa is the kind of fat man whose belly goes up and down when he laughs. In Afghanistan, he says, there's a lot of attention put on what you can and cannot say in public. For example, jokes you cannot say in public include jokes about the Taliban being gay. Also jokes about mullahs being greedy and dogmatic. And then lots of jokes that are just hard to know what they're about. Like this one that Mustafa tells me. A villager, a simple man, gets married, and he hires a videographer to film his wedding. The next day, his friends ask if they can see the video, and the villager says no, because there's a part at the end. The Afghans take one look at my rictus grin, and they apologize that their joke did not bring laughter to my beautiful lips. I feel terrible, of course, and later I ask Zach to explain, what does it mean, the part at the end?
You know, at the end, you know, the bride and groom go home together. You lose your virginity, ideally, although whatever.
Asking Zach to explain further makes him squirm like a minister, but he says that...
It's jokes like that that actually tell us something about the culture. In Afghan context, weddings and filming them is like a huge thing. Everybody wants to get a film made of their wedding. Big time, big time. Uh-huh.
So it takes the village idiot, who's an exaggerated version of the Afghan person, the Afghan folk, who's so obsessed with the video camera in his wedding that he actually films the sex scene after the wedding, right? And then it's too racy to show his friends the wedding video.
Yeah. It wouldn't be funny if you weren't telling something that violated some cultural assumption.
Cultural assumptions that you may have to know a lot about Afghanistan to understand.
And that, in a certain sense, if you can laugh at Afghan jokes, you know, you can really put yourself in an Afghan perspective in a whole new way.
Still, I'm not laughing out loud.
I know it's not that funny.
But the State Department advises its workers to avoid making jokes. Mm-hmm. Avoid humor. So as a traveler, what uses have jokes played
for
in
me?
Afghanistan for you?
I'll give you an example. Late at night, I was on my motorcycle.
This is in Kabul.
It's in Kabul. There's a police checkpoint, and the police stopped me. And they asked for my papers, passport, and so on. And I didn't have it. And I just joked with them. And they said, well, where are you from? And I said, Keshwari Shaitani Buzurkastam. I'm from the country of the great big Satan. And they cracked up. They thought it was hilarious. This guy joking about his own country. So they said, oh, no, but it's not a big Satan. It's a small Satan. If I'd given them my passport, they might have seen me as a way to get money. Not only did they let me go, they invited me over for tea, which is traditional. So I said, I took a coin, actually. I do a little bit of magic, and I reached over to their ear, and I pretended to pull out the coin from their ear. You know, and one of the policemen was kind of shocked, and then I took a little scarf, and I put it in my hand and made it disappear, and then reappear in the man's pocket. And they're both kind of just amazed, you know. So I said to him, can I have your Kalashnikov? Give me your Kalashnikov. And one of them looked at the other and said, okay, gave me his Kalashnikov. So there I am, midnight, on a motorcycle with a Kalashnikov. And I take it and I balance it on my chin for a couple seconds. Then I give it back to him. And they're floored. They're absolutely loving this. And then they, I think I may have pushed it a little bit too far. Because then they were like,
too far? After balancing the man's gun on your chin?
Well, they said you must stay with us. You must have tea with us. I had to really fight for about a good 10 minutes saying, I'm late, I have to go, I'm sorry, another time, blah, blah, blah. So now any time I went through that checkpoint afterwards, you know, I'd just wave at them and they'd laugh and I'd stop and we'd joke around a little bit. And that kind of access just been a cultural passport.
Zach Warren with a great tale of his own, ending that story from Afghanistan by reporter Gregory Warner. It was produced by BendingBorders.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on the world, why drinking a tequila is like drinking sunshine, literally.
You're drinking 10 years of a plant receiving the heat of Mexico. So it's not that tequila is stronger, but it certainly has this much more energy than other spirits, no?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org. And from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Mines are dangerous places to work, anywhere. Just look at the deaths this week of two coal miners in West Virginia, or the 8 miners killed in South Africa in February, or the 6 miners killed in Vietnam in January. You get the picture. But Tuesday's accident at a coal mine in Soma, Turkey, stands out. Nearly 300 confirmed dead already, and more we still don't know about. At this point, there's little hope of finding any more survivors. The scale of the disaster has sparked angry protests all over Turkey. Those protesters are blaming Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan for the poor safety in Turkish mines. Faruk Logoglu is an opposition member of parliament in Turkey and a former ambassador to the U.S. His party had been calling for increased mine safety long before the accident in Soma. Logoglu says the magnitude of this disaster is almost beyond comprehension.
This is by far the worst mine accident in the history of modern Turkey. And therefore, of course, accidents do occur, but the number of lives lost is just too much to absorb.
Now, we said that you had been taking up this safety issue before the accident. What made you worry that the mine was unsafe? And were you focusing specifically on the mine in Soma?
Some 20 members from our party signed this motion almost a year ago. And it so happened that the debate on this motion took place only a few weeks ago. And it was turned down by the government. The motion was not just about this particular mine, but a number of mines in the same area, in the area of district of Soma. And the reason for this motion was that safety standards were not up to par, and that a lot of accidents were occurring, some including fatalities, and therefore that the government should look into this situation, improve the safety and inspection standards of those standards.
Does Turkey have a history of mines with poor safety records?
Yes, unfortunately, we have a bad record in that respect. And that is why not this, just the motion that I mentioned, but our party presented a number of similar motions asking improvement in the standards of work safety. We have a bad record, unfortunately.
You're a member of the opposition in Turkey, as we said, and there have been calls from the opposition for Erdogan to resign over this. Can the opposition really be seen trying to build political capital on this terrible accident?
No. This is certainly the perception we are very, very diligently trying to stay away from, because we don't want to politicize the issue at this stage of the game. This is a mourning period, 3-day national mourning. All we are doing is expressing our solidarity with the families and making calls for national solidarity at this stage. But as the main opposition party, we will certainly pursue the issue in the days, weeks, and months ahead to see to it that this particular disaster has been fully investigated, and more importantly, ask the government and work with the government to improve safety standards in workplaces, but especially in the mines.
Faruk Logoglu, opposition member of the parliament in Turkey, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
When I heard about the mine disaster in Turkey on Tuesday, my thoughts turned to Chile. Remember 2010 and the 33 men who survived 69 days after their copper mine collapsed? That was near Copiapó, Chile, and it was 17 days before anyone even knew they were still alive. After their rescue, they became international heroes, honored guests on TV talk shows. The BBC's Gideon Long helped us cover that story in 2010, and he recently went back to Copiapó to find out how those men are doing now.
The men are all still alive. Most of them are still living in Copiapó. Many of them are in a poor state, though. They said that they primarily had two problems. The first was work. They found it difficult to find work. But secondly, and probably more importantly and more alarmingly, many of them still have psychological problems. That was the case with Carlos Barrios, for example. He was 27 years old at the time of the rock collapse. He said that he was fine when he came out for 2 years. He had a good job at another mine. He went back down the mines. He was playing football with his friends in a football team. And then 2 years after the accident, he suddenly just had a huge relapse. I met up with Carlos Barrios in Copiapó's main square in a cafe, and this is what he had to say to me.
They gave me brain tests, and the results weren't good. They sent me to Santiago for treatment, but the psychologists just gave me pills, pills, and more pills. I became addicted to pills. I'm still taking them. I have nightmares, a fear of the dark. I have a young daughter now, just 5 months old, but I can't sleep with her in my bed because I wake up thrashing my arms about. Mentally, I'm still very fragile.
Gideon, it sounds kind of like a PTSD of sorts. I mean, given these psychological challenges, how many of these miners went back to mining? I know you said Carlos did and then bailed from that second job.
Carlos did go back to mining, and several of the others did, or at least tried to as well. Some of them said that it was quite a challenge to go back down the mines for the first time, but many of them did try. Others said they had no interest in going down the mine. Some of the older miners retired. Some of them are working in construction. Some of them are doing odd jobs, working on the market in Copiapó or running errands. So it's a whole mix, really. But work has certainly been a problem. I spoke to one of the oldest miners, Omar Regadas, and he said that he'd been out of work for a year. And many of them feel as though they've been let down as well by the Chilean authorities. When they came out, there were all these promises made that they would be retrained, that they would find it easy to find jobs. Many indeed were predicting that they would be millionaires and they would never have to work again if they didn't want to. But they say that that's not the case. And when I was in Copiapó, I met up with Alex Vega. He was the 10th of the miners to be pulled to the surface. And this is what he had to say to me about the promises that were made to them when they were initially rescued.
I've lost all faith in the government. They promised a lot of things. They gave a pension to 14 of us, the oldest 14, but the rest of us, we were just left there. They promised us dental treatment because the water we were forced to drink from the underground tanks rotted our teeth, but that came to nothing. They promised to train us to improve our chances of finding work, but that didn't come to anything either.
I'm kind of surprised to hear these miners seem so kind of adrift. Have you spoken with the government, Gideon, and what do they say?
I have spoken to the government, and they say there's a limit in some sense to how much help they can give. They say that the welfare of the miners, and particularly their psychological welfare, is in the hands of a private association. So they say it's not really a matter for the state. The other big issue which the miners have is compensation. And I've spoken to the government about that. And again, the government says, well, you know, this is a matter for the courts. So the miners expect, and I think they're right to expect this, that it will take years before that compensation claim gets through the Chilean courts. So the government says it is sympathetic, but it also says there's a limit to what it can actually do.
Yeah, I want to ask you one more thing about this Hollywood version of the miners' story. It's called The 33. It's in production. It's got Antonio Banderas and Juliette Binoche. The miners have been promised a cut of the proceeds. They haven't gotten much joy from their own government. What about Hollywood? Will they make good?
Well, it seems so. When I was up there, it was in December, there was a lot of expectation about the film. And in February and in March, the film crew came down here. Juliette Binoche came down. Antonio Banderas came down. There was a huge hoo-ha. They actually went up to the mine and filmed at the mine itself. And the film is due to come out later in the year. And it does seem as though the production company have tried to include the 33 miners in that process. They included them in the sense of actually hiring them on the set. Some of the miners were interested in having small roles in the film. And they've also included them financially as well. And it does seem as though the film production company has treated this subject matter sensitively. It's been talking to the miners at every stage of the operation to try and get exactly what their story was and try and represent it faithfully in the film.
The BBC's Gideon Long bringing us up to date on the survivors of the 2010 mine disaster in Chile. Thank you, Gideon.
Thank you, Marco.
A shrine to sex, that's what this next story is about. A place in Indonesia that's part religious shrine for practitioners of an Indonesian version of Islam, part Plato's Retreat. And it's where Muslims from throughout the country gather every month or so to take part in a sexual ritual. I imagine at this point I have your full attention, and I'll let reporter Rebecca Henschke pick up the story from here.
So the ritual goes like this. First, offer up prayers and flowers at a sacred grave, then find a stranger of the opposite sex and have sex with them. Once he's finished reciting from the Quran, Pak Selamat will start looking for a partner.
In all the rooms around here, there are partners. They are small business people, and if you ask them, they say it works. That before business was slow, and now it's good.
So how about you?
Yes, I am keen. Here you are allowed to find a partner. It's just a matter of finding someone who wants the same thing. It's agreement between two people.
Are you married?
Yes, I'm doing this for business.
And does your wife know you're here?
No. Now she just knows I have gone to pray.
We exchange phone numbers and he promises to call when he's found someone.
Yeah.
Like tens of thousands of others, Selamat has come here to be blessed in a ritual that dates back hundreds of years. It's said that coming to Gunung Kumukus can boost fortunes, especially of needy workers like bus drivers, farmers or small market traders. Ibu Winda has four children and five grandchildren. She runs a small food stall in her hometown and has been coming here for 10 years. She says it works.
Ever since I have come here, business has been good. Praise to be Allah.
So now it's really dark and it's packed. There's people everywhere, women with headscarves and women with barely any clothes on at all mixing together with a lot of middle-aged men in leather jackets, and everyone's starting to pair up now underneath the roots of the trees. I asked my guides how they feel seeing girls nearly naked and women in headscarves both here for the ritual.
Itulah. That's Indonesia. Diverse. Very diverse. Here it's just accepted as normal. Do you think it's very hypocritical?
It certainly seems hypocritical. Even while Indonesia undergoes a steady shift towards more orthodox Islam, the ritual on Gunung Kumukus is exploding in popularity. But in Indonesia, something like this isn't all that surprising. In fact, it's typical of Indonesia's particular brand of Islam, which mixes early Hindu, Buddhist and traditional beliefs. Kunjoro Supano is a professor of sociology who's been researching these traditions for decades.
Indonesia is amazing buat saya. Kenapa?
Indonesia is amazing because whatever religion comes into Indonesia, it changes its color. The Islam is not just Islam like it is in Arab countries. Hinduism is different here to what it is in India. Buddhism is different from China. It's Indonesia's culturalization.
Professor Kunjoro Supano says as recently as the 1980s, Gunung Kumukus was an almost entirely undeveloped hill.
It used to be very different. What was happening was people were having sex out in the open, and the local government decided that was not a good idea. So they built bamboo huts around the shrine. But as a result, prostitution grew.
The shrine definitely has its detractors, especially as prostitution has increased. But the government is having none of it. The shrine is too valuable to shut down. Alongside the shrine is a row of thriving karaoke bars. Under the cover of darkness and the cloak of religion, Gunung Kumukus is a place where people can do things they couldn't do anywhere else. Fitri has left her four-year-old daughter with her mother for the night and has come up to the mountain for a good Friday night out. She's hooked up with a man who says he's here because business is slow and he needs some spiritual help.
He has been here 3 times. This is my first time. I wasn't really thinking. I just end up here.
It's 1 in the morning when I call Pak Selamat to see if he's found a partner. When I find him, he's still near the grave, praying.
I haven't found anyone yet. I'm looking for someone with a good heart. I want to find someone with the same missions as me for our business. Otherwise, it's not good.
He strokes my leg. Unless you want to be the one, he whispers. For The World, this is Rebecca Henschke in Central Java.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've got a geo-quiz for you today, and it's kind of a chicken or egg thing. Our friend Beto Arcos recently traveled to the town of Tequila in the Mexican state of Jalisco. And here's the quiz. Was the Mexican town named after tequila, or was tequila named after the town? Beto got the answer while speaking to the guy in charge at La Tequileña, one of the oldest distilleries in town.
My name is Sergio Mendoza.
And I come from a family of four generations dedicated to the cultivation of the agave plant, no, the raw material for the production of this amazing spirit, tequila. It is a well-known fact that the blue agave, the raw material for tequila, had been harvested and cultivated for many, many centuries before the Spanish came, no? But when you drink a tequila, it's like drinking sunshine in a very literal sense, no? Because you're drinking 10 years of a plant receiving the heat of Mexico, no? Very hot days, very cold nights. So it's not that tequila is stronger, but it certainly has this much more energy than other spirits, no?
So why is this drink called tequila?
Okay, that's something that has evolved in time, no? Tequila comes from an agave, no? Which is also commonly referred as mezcal. There's over 200 kinds of agaves. To produce tequila, we only use one kind, which is agave azul. So mezcal is the generic name, no? Tequila is actually a mezcal. All tequila is a mezcal, but not all mezcal is a tequila. So people started to realize that the specific mezcal or mezcal wine from the region of tequila was very particular. It had a lot of complexity and a lot of smoothness. And to distinguish it from other mezcals, they started referring to it as the mezcal wine of tequila, no? Mezcal wine of tequila. Now we know it as tequila.
So the city of Tequila gave the name to the drink.
Exactly. It gave the specific name to the mezcal wine of tequila.
Sergio, tell me what we're going to try. We're going to do a tasting of tequila.
We're going to start with the Blanco, which is the purest expression of the agave plant, no? And it's also a favorite of this region of Mexico, no? It's one of the most complex, no? It has a lot of beautiful aromas even before going into a barrel. I'm going to pass it to you. I perceive there are a lot of hints of fruits, no? And we're talking about an 80 proof product, no? 40% alcohol by volume.
It's very smooth.
It's very smooth.
Sergio, I'm happy to say that I really enjoy good Blanco tequila.
That's fantastic and very pure. All its sweetness comes directly from the plant. As I said, the purest expression of the agave fields.
Wonderful. Sergio Mendoza, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
A big thanks to Beto Arcos for sending us that GeoQuiz. The answer, as you heard, is that tequila, the drink, gets its name from Tequila, the town, in the Mexican state of Jalisco. Finally today, remember Andre the Giant? He was the extra-large actor and professional wrestler who starred in The Princess Bride. There's a new graphic novel about him called Andre the Giant, Life and Legend. His real name was Andre René Roussimoff, born in France, and despite his fame, he didn't always have a great life. Andre suffered from a medical condition that caused him to grow way beyond normal size. That meant living in a world that was too small for him, a reality that illustrator Box Brown tried to reflect in his graphic novel.
I wasn't super concerned about making him look accurately the same size in every panel. I was mostly concerned with just making him the biggest thing in the room, the biggest thing on the page, the biggest thing in the panel. So I wanted people to get the feel of how enormous he was and how big his presence was. It helps when you add small objects or regular size objects in his hand and they look really small.
And what about Andre the Giant, the person? I mean, so much of what we know about him still seems to be embedded in folklore. How do you research somebody like this who died in 93? I mean, you've got to kind of reverse engineer it out of popular imagination and into reality.
Yeah, I mean, I did the best that I could to get the truth and, you know, take from what's considered to be fact. But the nature of professional wrestling is to basically lie to the fans and the public. Even in the case when the wrestler is giving a what is known to be a shoot interview or a real interview, you know, there's still something about these people that work in pro wrestling that they can still be working the crowd, their audience, the promoter, each other. So they tend to exaggerate and you have to kind of just do what you think is right.
you say lie because
what you have.
You say they're lying because they're not really wrestling. It's entertainment, right?
Sure. Yeah. It's a performance.
Right. Did Andre have issues with that performance, that kind of artifice?
I don't think so. I mean, back then it was a little bit different. I mean, now we all know it's a performance. I think for most of the history of the business, it was something where the people involved always sold it to be a true thing. So he was very much living that part. You know, you can tell from his work that he studied his craft and really knew what he was doing. He knew how to work the crowd. He knew how to work a match and make himself look like a good guy and make himself look like a bad guy and how to make the crowd cheer how to make the crowd boo.
There's one battle between Andre and Hulk Hogan in 1987. I gather you went back and studied that match kind of frame by frame. What did that show you?
I did that because I really wanted the reader to actually understand what a wrestler is doing in the ring. On face value, it looks like one thing. And when you break it down panel by panel or frame by frame, you see that it's these two performers working together. It's improvisation in a way, but I don't think the average person who sees a match understands what's actually happening in the ring.
How would you describe your new appreciation of Andre the Giant?
I just think of him as this, as a master artist, and I think of him as a tragic figure who maybe didn't fit into this world the way that we all do, and he had a very difficult life, and he had his ups and downs like we all do, and I think that I'm glad that I was able to express my appreciation for what he did for me as a kid and what he'd done for millions of people across the world. And, you know, I think that he and other wrestlers need to be appreciated as artists, the artists that they are and the interesting people that they are.
Well, you certainly helped in that respect, Box. Box Brown, the author and illustrator of the new graphic novel, Andre the Giant, Life and Legend. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
You can see excerpts from Box Brown's graphic novel at PRI.org. We'll go out on Andre the Giant's previous Walk to the Ring music, Angry Again by Megadeth. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Arts, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.